We don't want the 2017 legislative session to be dominated by fights over oil taxes.
The state's top tax man is hoping to avoid another fight over oil and gas taxes in Juneau. From the Alaska Public Radio Network, this is Alaska News Nightly for Thursday, December 1st. Good evening, I'm Zachariah Hughes. Also tonight, Anchorage police graduate more than two dozen new officers.
We have about 360 officers working independently full-time on the streets of Anchorage, which is a lot more than what we had in 2015.
Those stories and more tonight on Alaska News Nightly.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline.
A local native corporation is suing the city formerly known as Barrow, demanding it halts the official name change to Utqiagvik. And for now, although the change has been made official, the city is halting the use of public money to implement the change till the courts have reached a judgment. The temporary restraining order was filed Wednesday by lawyers representing Utqiagvik Inupiat Corporation, or UIC. In materials submitted to the state court, UIC alleges the city council voted to put the name change on the October 4th municipal ballot without providing the required notice to the Barrow public. The filing also claims that after repeated requests, city officials have failed to provide any public notices or meeting minutes about the name change ordinance from when it passed on August 25th, a possible violation of municipal rules. The main contention of the lawsuit is that the city council's actions led to the passage of a flawed law and risks spending public money to change signs, contracts, and seals that won't be able to be recovered. Fanny Suvlu is the mayor of Utqiagvik and presided over the ceremonial renaming earlier this afternoon. She says the city appeared in court today, but it hardly settles the matter as it waits for judgment.
As far as money being spent on, like, changing the signage around town, I believe, you know, once we have a clearer idea of what's actually happening in the court system, I'll have a better opportunity to address that question.
Suvlu has also introduced an ordinance to the city council that would put the issue back before voters, asking whether they'd like to repeal the name change or not. She says that could appear during a special election in March. Utqiagvik city council member Kuyan Harcharik said the members were disappointed that money was being spent by the local native corporation on the naming issue. Alaska's leaders are getting ready for tough negotiations over how the state will deal with its multi-billion dollar budget hole. How much the oil and gas industry should help fill that hole will be an especially controversial question for the legislature this session. But during a speech to industry leaders today, Governor Bill Walker's top tax man said he wants to make lawmakers focus on the big picture instead. Elizabeth Harbaugh from Alaska's Energy Desk reports.
Ken Alper, director of the Alaska Department of Revenue's Tax Division, has a dream.
We don't want the 2017 legislative session to be dominated by fights over oil taxes. We just don't.
That dream may not come true. Last session, Governor Bill Walker and the legislature went back and forth over oil taxes well into the summer months. But at a breakfast hosted by the Resource Development Council, which advocates for the industry, Alper said the state should instead focus on bigger changes to fix its budget shortfall. This means two things: an income tax or a sales tax, and a change in how Alaska uses earnings from the permanent fund. These are things Governor Walker proposed last year. But the legislature didn't pass the comprehensive plan the governor had in mind. So Walker infuriated the oil and gas industry by vetoing about $430 million in tax credits that were promised to the companies. Alper says the governor wants to pay those credits back, but it depends on how the legislature moves forward this year.
You know, I expect that this year there will be a pretty similar dynamic, where the governor's comfort level for paying off these obligations is going to increase dramatically the closer we get to a fiscal solution.
Even though he wants to avoid a fight, Alper says changes to oil taxes are probably going to be part of the solution. All of those changes will be tough, but Alper says they have to happen this year, or the state will be in danger of draining its savings account.
So if no solution is passed this coming session, it means that the legislature in 2018 can't balance the budget, period. And at that point, it means almost a panic, hair on fire budgeting 1 year from now.
After the speech, Alaska Oil and Gas Association leader Kara Moriarty said she agrees with Alper. She doesn't want to squabble over oil taxes this year either. But oil companies are also worried about how the governor plans to deal with the issue.
He didn't say anything today that gives us any certainty or any stability. Even though he doesn't want oil taxes to dominate the legislative session, it's still going to be part of the package, but it's still not clear what that is.
If the governor's budget proposal is anything like what he released last year, which included raising taxes on oil and gas, then the industry is ready to fight it. Governor Walker is slated to release the budget on December 15th. From Alaska's Energy Desk, I'm Elizabeth Harbaugh in Anchorage.
A state corporation has agreed to change the terms of a multi-million dollar loan to a Cook Inlet oil company because of those vetoed oil tax credits from last year. Texas-based Blue Crest asked for the loan modification to help the company deal with construction delays and the loss of millions in delayed payments from the state. Rasha McChesney of Alaska's Energy Desk has more from Juneau.
In 2015, the state agreed to give Texas-based Blue Crest Energy Incorporated and its subsidiaries a $30 million line of credit to buy a drilling rig and camp. The company is using them to produce oil from the Cosmopolitan field in southern Cook Inlet. The project is supposed to produce thousands of barrels of oil a day in Cook Inlet and bring in more than $150 million in new oil taxes and royalties to the state. But there were delays in the completion of the drilling rig, and that led to postponed oil production from the field. Then, Governor Bill Walker decided to postpone millions in tax credit payments the state owes to the company. Now, Blue Crest is asking the Alaska Industrial Development and Export Authority to change the terms of its loan. It wants to make interest-only payments for most of 2017, and it wants to lower the amount of money it keeps in an account that would reimburse the state if the company defaults on its loan. The authority's board members heard public testimony during their December 1st meeting. Some Kenai Peninsula residents were dismayed that the company is getting financing at all, let alone being allowed to relax the terms of its loan.
I don't have a clue how that would be a worthy investment. With the price of oil, it's been discussed already, it seems to be a huge gamble.
That's Katie Kennedy. She lives in Ninilchik, a community neighboring Blue Crest's pad. She says Blue Crest's ties to a now bankrupt energy company that also operated in Cook Inlet show that the company doesn't deserve a state loan. But others say the company has a viable business plan that was derailed when it lost tax credit revenue it needed to meet the terms of the loan. Kara Moriarty, president and CEO of the Alaska Oil and Gas Association, placed the blame for the loan modification squarely on the shoulders of the state.
We're here not because of anything Blue Crest did. It was part of the business plan the state was aware of with ADA that the tax credit payment would be part of the financial package for ADA and for Blue Crest. And with the governor's veto, it has caused a lot of companies to refinance their projects. There are other companies that had to do the same thing with private lending institutions.
Ultimately, board members unanimously voted to modify the loan. From Alaska's Energy Desk in Juneau, I'm Rasha McChesney.
The Anchorage Police Department is moving closer to a years-long goal of boosting the size of the force. Today, 26 new officers graduated from the department's second police academy of the year, and in a few weeks, more than 30 additional officers will enter a third academy. APD Communications Director Jennifer Castro says whether it's on paper or on the street, there are just more police working in Anchorage.
We have about 360 officers working independently full-time on the streets of Anchorage, which is a lot more than what we had in 2015. The beginning of 2015, we only had 320 officers working full-time.
The new graduates will still have months of field training before they're working totally on their own. And though the department won't know until roughly the beginning of the new year how many older officers will opt to retire, Castro is confident the department's goal of 400 officers will soon be met and expect the results of that expanded force to be evident by next fall.
What we're really replenishing is on patrol. And with this added growth, we're now able to supply anywhere between 24 to 28 officers on each shift, which is great because it allows the officers to respond, be at more places, go to more calls, but also to have some opportunities eventually to do more proactive policing because they will have that time available.
Staffing levels at APD are a source of political controversy in Anchorage and were a main campaign promise of current Mayor Ethan Berkowitz during the 2015 campaign. Even the 400-officer target is on the low end of what was recommended in a comprehensive report during the last mayor's administration. Castro says the recent gains are a much-needed asset after years of a declining force amid more calls for service. Still to come on Alaska News Nightly, snuffed out. Alaska's public housing will go completely smoke-free, but not right now.
April or May, when it's a little warmer and people can adjust to the requirement that they have to go outside to smoke.
That's ahead. Stay with us.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by Arctic Wire Rope and Supply, stocking a variety of tire chains from passenger vehicles to heavy equipment. On the web at arcticwirerope.com. And by Wells Fargo, extending its support of Alaska residents beyond banking by supporting the programming of public radio throughout Alaska, giving back to the community. Wells Fargo, together we'll go far.
Anchorage School District's officials say they've investigated a threat of gun violence at Chugiak High School, although they don't think the threat is credible. ASD spokesperson Heidi Embley says a graffiti message scrawled on a school wall made the threat there that there would be a shooting at the school on Friday. ASD officials have investigated the threats, according to ASD spokesperson Heidi Embley, and additional police will be at the school on Friday. Chugiak administrators plan to issue automated calls to parents advising them of the situation. Classes are scheduled for Friday, but students who stay at home will not be counted as absent, according to the school district. The Obama administration announced Thursday an overhaul to an often cumbersome process that dictates oil and gas drilling, grazing, and other activities on lands administered by the U.S. Bureau of Land Management. The administration says its new rule will increase public involvement and government transparency. Bureau of Land Management Deputy Director Linda Lance told the Associated Press that the move increases public involvement in land use plans that dictate the development across almost 250 million acres in 12 western states, including Alaska, as well as the Dakotas. Some members of Congress, industry groups, and local officials have criticized the overhaul. They say it prioritizes preservation above energy development and other uses and shifts decision-making to Washington, D.C. Among the changes, alternatives for development would be offered at the front end of planning instead of later in the process. Lance says the changes could shave years off a process that currently averages 8 years. The overhaul updates regulations first adopted in 1979. The Alaska Department of Education and Early Development today announced the new vendor for statewide student assessments to replace the problem-plagued Alaska Measures of Progress test. APRN's Josh Edge reports.
After consulting stakeholders from around the state, including school district leadership, officials from the state's education organizations, district test coordinators, and teachers, the state selected Data Recognition Corporation, or DRC, as its new student assessment vendor. Brian Laurent with the State Department of Education and Early Development says the company has a history in Alaska.
DRC obviously has experience with the technology and infrastructure in Alaska, specifically the challenges in parts of our state, specifically rural Alaska, with the technology.
DRC partnered with the state for nearly a decade to administer the statewide student assessment prior to the more recent Alaska Measures of Progress test. And the company currently administers the state's English language proficiency assessments. The state's former test was plagued by technical issues, which interrupted testing and delayed results. Teachers and school officials also questioned the usefulness of the old test results, saying it lacked detailed enough information to properly assess students' learning. Laurent believes the new test addresses those concerns.
With the example reports that were provided, just on their own, were an improvement compared to the reports that our previous assessment vendor released in 2015 for the Alaska Measures of Progress.
Laurent says some of the customization options for the reports include the balance between text and graphics and the types of graphics used in the reports in an effort to make them more user-friendly for teachers, parents, and others who may be reviewing the results. While the vendor has been chosen, many of the details of the test itself have not yet been finalized. An exact price tag has not been determined, though Laurent says it will fit within the state's $4.45 million assessment budget for the upcoming year, of which the federal government contributes approximately $3.5 million. The DRC assessment covers English language, arts, and math, as well as separate, less frequent testing in science. The next testing window for Alaska schools is March 28th through April 28th, 2017. In Anchorage, I'm Josh Edge.
A new federal rule bans smoking in public housing nationwide. The notice was released Wednesday by the Department of Housing and Urban Development, and it'll take effect in 18 months. But Alaska is looking to do it a lot sooner, in 5 to 6 months.
April or May, when it's a little warmer and people can adjust to the requirement that they have to go outside to smoke.
Kathy Stone is the director of the Alaska Housing Finance Corporation, which runs public housing throughout the state. The federal ban applies to lit tobacco products like cigarettes, pipes, and cigars. It doesn't apply to electronic cigarettes, but the state is leaning towards eliminating those as well. Smoking marijuana in public housing is a federal offense, regardless of state law. Stone says the reason Alaska's ban would come early is because the state's public housing has already been developing its own non-smoking policy.
Very expensive to turn a unit after someone's been smoking in it. You know, sometimes you have to replace the carpet. You have to paint the wall multiple times.
All that work can cost an extra 30 to 50% and tack an extra 2 to 3 days onto the time required to flip a non-smoker's unit. Alaska Public Housing wants to offer resources like hotlines and classes to help people quit smoking when the ban takes effect. Those resources would vary by area and by interest. Tonight, Eielson Air Force Base is updating residents around Moose Creek about perfluorinated compounds, or PFCs, in the groundwater. As KUAC's Robert Hannon reports, in 2015, testing revealed contamination from firefighting foam.
It's been several years since the Air Force discovered PFC-tainted water on base and in the nearby community of Moose Creek. Gary Fink with the Air Force Civil Engineer Center says two particular compounds pose potential risk.
The contaminant of concern is PFOS and PFOA. And so far, there's been 169 residents that have exceeded the EPA health advisory.
Fink says the Air Force early on offered bottled water to affected homes, and to date, it has either installed water holding tanks or filtration systems for 159 homes. He says testing has identified the edge of the 6.5-mile plume, and it's currently stable, but that could change. Fink says the Air Force is looking at various long-term solutions.
Either hooking up to an existing distribution system like North Pole, or installing tanks at every house. There's several options we're looking at.
Eric Breitenberger is program director with the Alaska Department of Environmental Conservation. He generally gives the Air Force high marks for its response in getting safe drinking water to Moose Creek residents, but he says PFCs are an emerging contaminant, meaning there's a lot of unknowns associated with them, including how long they stick around in the environment.
Materials are very stable. That's why they're used in firefighting foam applications, because they don't readily degrade. But we don't have a lot of information on how long they'll persist in groundwater. Initial indications are that it will probably be several decades and perhaps longer.
Breitenberger says PFCs pose a significant national problem. Tonight's meeting is from 6 to 7 p.m. at the Moose Creek Fire Station. In Fairbanks, I'm Robert Hannon.
Alaska News Nightly is brought to you in part by the law firm of Landy Bennett Blumstein, attorneys who know the people, businesses, tribes, and communities of Alaska. Landy Bennett Blumstein, online at lbblawyers.com. And by Northern Air Cargo, providing freight transportation to 13 rural Alaska communities. NAC offers a variety of service options to get the freight where it needs to be safely. Northern Air Cargo, serving Alaska since 1956. It's a fact, 85% of Alaska Native and American Indian people don't use illegal drugs. For more resources on building a healthy life, visit anthc.org/weare. This message sponsored by ANTHC, a nonprofit organization.
FBI statistics show the number of hate crimes is on the rise nationally, but only 8 were reported in Alaska last year. Local officials say that's not necessarily because they aren't happening, they just don't know about them. A recent class taught community members how to remedy that by recognizing and reporting hate crimes. Alaska Public Media's Anne Hillman learned more.
When someone commits a crime like vandalism or assault because of a bias against a certain group, that's a hate crime. It includes things like spray painting racist messages on a mosque or threatening to hurt a transgender person for moving into a certain neighborhood. Some things, like harassment or vandalism at a school, are usually investigated at a local level, but some are taken on by the FBI. FBI Special Agent Steve Forrest says it's often really hard to prove that a violent act is a hate crime. Hate has to be an obvious factor, like someone shouting derogatory terms while assaulting someone else.
Other hate crimes that involve violence, if you're going to report those as a hate crime, we're going to need to prove that the individual targeted the person because of their race. So any sort of history maybe of racial animus towards a group may be something that we could use to build a case, that type of thing, if it's not more obvious than that.
Some things that people may think fall into the category are really protected speech.
People say a lot of horrible things, unfortunately, and there's not much we can do about that. So, but it can evolve into threats or harassment. It can evolve into harassment. So that type of thing might be something we'd look at. But for the most part, that's going to be free speech, as bad as that may seem.
Bajek Ding from the South Sudanese community in Anchorage attended the class so he could teach others about their rights. He says he sees discrimination, but many people in the community don't know that they can report it to the local police and the FBI.
We need to learn the law and to tell our community that some people, they don't know their right, that some people are doing something bad to them, but they don't know where they go.
Lucy Hansen with the Polynesian Association of Alaska helped coordinate the event, which was attended by about 25 people.
You know, with what's been going on around in the world, and our new leaders for the America is coming up, you know. I think it's an important time for everybody to learn and to understand, you know, this.
Hansen says oftentimes people don't report hate crimes because they're afraid of interacting with the police, but classes like this can ease that problem. FBI agent Forrest says the agency wants to know about all potential hate crimes, both from the community and local law enforcement. Even if they don't rise to the level of federal crimes, it can help the FBI track potential trends and threats. From the Urban Affairs Desk, I'm Ann Hillman.
Positioned south of Russia's Kamchatka Peninsula and north of Japan, the little-known Kuril Islands played a pivotal role in the Pacific Theater during World War II. Alaska Public Media's Lori Townsend spoke with historian John H. Klo about his book Missions to the Kurils, detailing the island's significance to American airmen during the war and about their continued role in global politics.
There's a string of islands, about 50 or so, to stretch from the tip of the Kamchatka Peninsula down to Hokkaido, Japan. And they have traditionally belonged to the Japanese, either through treaty or possession. There are three groupings, the Northern Kurils, up near the Kamchatka, of course, the Central Kurils, and the Southern Kurils, which are still like a bone of contention between Japan and Russia. They've never really signed a peace agreement over. The Japanese refer to them as our Northern Territory. And the Russians, Soviet Union, grabbed them after World War II.
Why were they so important? What role did they play in World War II?
Well, we built bases on Attu after the battle and on nearby Shimya. We stationed aircraft there. And basically, they had a couple of objectives. One was to destroy the infrastructure in the northern and central Kurils. And the other thing was go after the fishing infrastructure, you know, the canneries ashore, the ships at sea. You know, the outbreak of World War II, the Japanese lost the fishing rights in the North Pacific and in the Aleutian area. So this is a big source of food for the country. So, you know, World War II against Japan was sort of a war of attrition, you know, trying to wear them down, literally starve them into submission.
Were the Kuril Islands important for helping people who were injured or had aircraft that couldn't make it to their American bases? Were there places for them to get help there?
Yes, Soviet Union, Petropavlovsk, Kamchatka Peninsula. The situation at the time, it's like the closest distance between Attu and the Northern Kurils is 750 miles, straight distance. So they are operate in extreme ranges because they had to, of course, do doglegs and weather and, you know, whatever, navigational. So, I mean, they didn't have much gas to get back to the Aleutians with. So if they got shot up, had mechanical problems, ran into bad weather, rather than trying to get back and winding up in the ocean somewhere, they would divert over to Petropavlovsk. And it was about 350-some crew members did that during the course of the war.
So interesting. Why is it important for people to understand the role that the Kurile Islands had in World War II today? Why is it relevant today, and why is this important?
Well, it's a new topic. It was the first launch of an air attack against the Japanese islands from the North American continent. And that was the first attack since the Doolittle Raid in April 42, and we launched the next attack in July of 43 from Attu. And I think it's important to know, you know, like for 1,000 people, American GIs died up there during this time. And it's important to the public to know about it. That's what I believe. World War II in the Pacific began in the Kuriles, and it ended in the Kuriles. The Japanese used the Southern Kuriles to assemble their carrier task force for the attack on Pearl Harbor. They, you know, gathered them all up together in a big assembly area and sorted it all out, and then steamed across the North Pacific out of the shipping lanes and bombed Pearl Harbor in December of 41. The war ended there. Hirohito, the Japanese emperor, announced the surrender of Japan, and all hostilities stopped, except the Russians, about 3 days later, invaded the Kuriles to grab territory. So that was the last battle fought in the North Pacific, was in the Kurile Islands.
And that's all for this edition of Alaska News Nightly. Tonight's stories can be found on our website at alaskapublic.org. You can like us on Facebook at Alaska Public Media and follow us on Twitter at APRN. We had reports tonight from Anne Hillman, Elizabeth Harbaugh, and Josh Edge in Anchorage, Rasha McChesney in Juneau, Anna Rose MacArthur in Bethel, and Robert Hannon in Fairbanks. Our audio engineer is Dave Waldron. Wesley Early is our web editor. Sean Dugan is our news editor and producer. And I'm Zachariah Hughes. Good night.
Alaska News Nightly was made possible in part by your local public radio station.
Alaska's Tobacco Quitline reminds you that 88% of Alaskans don't allow smoking in their homes. A smoke-free environment helps prepare kids for a healthier life and a future free from tobacco. And it makes good economic sense. Secondhand smoke damages property, decreasing its value. Exposure to its toxins leads to disease and increased medical costs. Call 1-800-QUIT-NOW or enroll online at alaskaquitline.com. This message brought to you by Alaska's Tobacco Quitline. The Older Persons Action Group is the publisher of the monthly Senior Voice newspaper and the 2016 Directory for Older Alaskans. To order the directory or to learn more, go to seniorvoicealaska.com. This message sponsored by OPAG. If you have an opinionated teenager in your home who thrives on proving a point, check out the Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future Scholarship Competition organized by UAA's Seawolf Debate Program. More than $10,000 in prizes will be awarded. Debating Alaska's Fiscal Future gives the next generation of Alaskans a voice in the direction of our state. Contest details available at debatingakfuture.com. This message sponsored by Seawolf Debate.
This is APRN, the Alaska Public Radio Network.